Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For several years, we've been following the long and twisted tale of the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal, proposed for Coos Bay, and its companion Pacific Connector gas pipeline, which would snake across much of southern Oregon, carrying frack gas to Jordan Cove. In the past year, the struggle to stop this project has heated up and is starting to receive national and international attention. On January 21st, the Oregon Department of State Lands, the DSL, rejected Jordan Cove's latest request for an extension on the removal fill permit application required for the proposal to proceed. DSL announced that they would make a final decision on the permit by January 31st. Fearing a denial, 2 days later, Jordan Cove withdrew their permit application. Tomorrow morning at 9:30, Jordan Cove opponents are holding a press conference to discuss DSL's decision at the Department of State Lands office at 775 Summer Street Northeast in Salem. In keeping with all these developments, today we're rebroadcasting part two of my radio documentary, Holding the Thin Green Line. This segment on the campaign to stop Jordan Cove has been updated since its initial broadcast last October to reflect some recent developments which are raising hopes that the project will be defeated sooner than later.
We're blessed that we're in a place where water flows out of the ground. I can take you to a hillside where a small river flows right out of the hillside. And those places are special places for cleansing and ceremony and vision quest. Without clean water, we won't survive.
Every morning, we watch the sun come up over the Elliott Forest and shines on our little piece of paradise on the edge of Haines Inlet, the northern arm of Coos Bay. Several years ago, the North Bend Airport came to us and asked us, as part of wetland mitigation, to create wildlife habitat on our property. And now we've got a lovely 13-acre area that's tidelands, new salt marsh habitat, and some coho rearing habitat.
I get revitalized when I look out that window and I see that herd of elk that now has a place where it doesn't have to cross the road to get to the river for water because we've restored watershed up here. This is our sanctuary. This is our dream. This is something my husband and I have worked all of our lives to be able to have and enjoy and pass on to our children.
You're listening to Holding the Thin Green Line, Part 3, Jordan Cove, a story about a massive liquid natural gas export terminal and pipeline that wouldn't die.
In 2004, a company called Fort Chicago proposed a facility in Coos Bay to import liquefied natural gas.
Dan Sears is the conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper in Portland, Oregon, and has been working to stop LNG projects for much of his adult life.
I was working with my brother, Joe. He started a really small nonprofit in Grants Pass called Friends of Living Oregon Waters. One of our board members at the time saw this proposal in Coos Bay and sent it to Joe. We both drank a bunch of beer at a bar in Ashland and tried to figure out what could anyone do about something like this. And several beers in, we made the decision that we were gonna really work on this. Joe saw that this was going to be a long fight. And I was like, well, I'm not doing anything else right now, so let's do it.
In California, they had all these proposals for LNG import terminals, and citizens rose up and defeated every single one of those.
Jody McCaffrey is a longtime anti-LNG activist who has lived all her life in Southern Oregon, along Coos Bay. She's the director of Citizens for Renewables, a volunteer organization that has been fighting the Jordan Cove LNG terminal for nearly 15 years.
Well, then they moved up here. They were fighting in California, these terminals 14 miles offshore because of the safety hazards. And I'm thinking, this is less than a mile from our airport. Why would we want this up here?
People in California had actually been fighting LNG longer than we had and had a lot of knowledge that they were able to transfer north about why it was really a questionable idea.
November of 2004, they filed a notice of intent with the Oregon Department of Energy. It was announced there was going to be a meeting, and I had done some research and I had had some concerns on the safety stuff. And so I went, FERC was there, the Oregon Department of Energy, and the applicant, Jordan Cove. The room was crowded, it was at the City Hall in Coos Bay.
I remember Jody getting up and giving a very good presentation about some of the risks and getting interrupted and shouted down by a bunch of old white men in the room. One who I think literally said, Jody, you're a pretty lady, but you don't know what you're talking about. And actually some people got up and left. Remember afterwards, Jody saying to me, oh man, that was a disaster. And a couple of us just said, I don't think so, actually. I think those people who left were with you. They signed in. And sure enough, that night and the next day, she started getting a whole bunch of phone calls and emails from people who were hearing what was going on and were angry that people were trying to silence her.
Bob Braddock, who was with Jordan Cove, told me in December of 2004, Sandia National Laboratories had come out with an analysis of these hazards, and he told me to go read that analysis and it would ease my mind. And I went and got that report, and then I started asking questions of people that could help me with some of the terms in it, because I wasn't a scientist and I didn't know what those hazard codes meant. And then when I found out what they meant, that people a mile away would be at risk of second-degree burns in 30 seconds, I thought, oh my gosh, why would we want this here?
When Jordan Cove first proposed their idea, they were initially implying that they would use the existing 12-inch pipeline in Coos County. Jody did the math and figured out you can't fit a billion cubic feet in a 12-inch line. I remember very clearly the Port Commission meeting where she called them out and said, so tell me what's going on here. We think there's another pipeline. We're pretty sure of it. And lo and behold, a couple weeks later, the Pacific Connector was proposed.
I went down to the bottom of my hill to go out my gate, and there was a white pickup truck down there trying to get in my gate.
Stacy McLaughlin is a Southern Oregon landowner in Douglas County, impacted by the Pacific Connector pipeline.
He informed me that he was here to do a survey on the McLaughlin property. We had not asked for any surveys of our property. And I inquired about the purpose of the survey, and he said, oh, we're going to be building a pipeline to bring natural gas into the community. And I said, I don't think I know anything about this, so we'll just pass on that survey. I locked the gate, and he went on his way. About a year later, there was a notice that we received in the mail from the county telling us about a hearing that was taking place regarding the pipeline. Well, we were not on the route originally.
I was in the living room, and I noticed there was a FedEx truck that had just pulled up to the front gate. He had one of those overnight envelopes. And so I took it from him, of course, immediately opened it up, and here was a 3 or 4 page letter from Jordan Cove. And the first sentence was, we think you're aware by now, which we weren't, but you are on the proposed route of the Pacific Gas Connector pipeline.
Larry Magnin is a retired wildlife biologist who lives on a 100-acre ranch along Haines Inlet in the upper part of Coos Bay.
You almost want to fall down when you read something like that. You read every word dozens of times. And their letter basically said, we want to access your property, and if you don't want to sell, we will take it through eminent domain.
We had never, ever in our mind dreamed that something like a pipeline could be a threat.
Sylvia Mangan is a retired public health nurse living with her husband Larry along Haines Inlet.
We denied them access. We felt like it would be an assault to our beautiful land and our dream.
In 2009, it was an import project. In 2011, they were already at the Federal Department of Energy saying, hey, we really aren't going to be able to do this domestically, so we think we should be exporting.
We knew when it was an import terminal that there was no need for import. They were trying to say that Canada was running out of gas. And all those reports they threw at us were all wrong. They justified it being in the public interest because it was bringing gas to Americans. Now it's an export pipeline just for them, doesn't bring gas to anybody but them, and they're wanting to still use those permits.
The Pacific Connector pipeline would be 230 miles long and 36 inches wide, which is a huge transmission pipeline.
It would connect to a pre-existing pipeline called the Ruby Pipeline that comes in from Wyoming.
Robin Jansen is the director of Rogue Riverkeeper, a nonprofit organization focused on protecting and restoring clean water and native fish in the Rogue River Basin in Southern Oregon.
And it would run it through Southern Oregon, through the Upper Rogue Basin, through Klamath, Jackson, Douglas, and Coos counties, to the coast, to Coos Bay.
And Coos Bay is where the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas facility would be built. They would super cool the gas into a liquid so that they can actually fit it onto these huge tanker ships and export it overseas.
Hannah Soule is the executive director of Rogue Climate, a grassroots climate action and environmental justice organization in Jackson County in Southern Oregon.
The pipeline itself would go under almost 500 rivers and streams in Southern Oregon.
It would cross under the Klamath River, the Rogue River, the Umpqua, the Coquille, and then major parts of Coos Bay.
We're at the site of the proposed crossing where the Pacific Connector pipeline would go underneath the Rogue River using what's known as horizontal directional drilling technology.
Stacy Detweiler is the conservation director with Rogue Riverkeeper.
The river is cold and clear, and we're surrounded by trees.
They have to start hundreds of feet off the river and burrow this huge tunnel under the river through bedrock, and then they feed the pipe through it.
building a massive LNG pipeline here would have the potential to really impact the health of the river and the communities that rely upon it, largely because of the potential for what's known as a frack out. If the large drills that are used to go underneath the river fracture the bedrock, they could release chemicals and drilling contaminants into the river itself.
If they try one route and it doesn't work, they don't have a plan B necessarily. You don't get to just keep trying over and over. It's like trying to give somebody a shot and you can't find the vein, and then they just end up with this giant bruise.
The proposed pipeline would cross through approximately 88 different waterways in the Upper Rogue watershed. The company proposes to do what's called a dry open cut, where they trench, blast, dam, divert the waterway so that they can build the pipeline through it. And that has the potential to increase sediment, and the proposal to cut down riparian vegetation, trees, and shrubs that are next to the stream that help to keep the stream cool can actually increase temperature pollution for a lot of these waterways. All those little waterways that flow into the Rogue help to keep the Rogue cool, and keeping them clean is really important to protecting the health of our river.
There is not a day in this country or the world where there is not a pipeline explosion. It is not if this pipeline explodes, it's when this pipeline explodes.
They're not supposed to be near a large population center. They're supposed to be in an isolated area, and certainly where it's geographically sound land. Not only is it in a population area, but we are an earthquake waiting to happen.
It's not if, it's when the earthquake comes. There's no way in the world they can design a pipeline to survive an event like that.
This company has been so bold as to suggest that Jordan Cove LNG energy plant will withstand any natural disaster that we've experienced in history. Now, how could anybody make that claim with a straight face?
If there was an explosion, about 17,000 people are within the blast zones. Anybody living 500 meters away from where the ships would come and go from the ocean into the facility and around the two big tanks that hold the LNG would be instantly cremated. Out to 1.1 miles, people could die if they don't get cover within 15 or 20 seconds. And then out to 2.2 miles, they could have serious burns. The airport is less than a mile from the facility itself. The entire college, several schools, fire department, the Coast Guard, the ones that we're expecting to be there to rescue us is within that blast zone.
If it does go in, that project's not going to be there forever, 30, 35 years.
Doc Slider is an elder with the Coos Lower Umpqua Susla tribes.
What's going to happen at the end of this period? Who's going to be responsible for going around and cleaning up that mess? Are they going to come out and they're going to take those pipes out of their land? Are they just going to leave it and let it deteriorate?
The dredging for this project would be the biggest dredging project in Oregon's recent history.
Allie Rosenbluth is a campaign director with Rogue Climate.
That would have huge impacts on fish in the bay.
We're on the edge of Coos Bay right now. We're right next to the shipping channel. A couple hundred yards this side is where the entrance bay for the big LNG tankers is going to be excavated into that hill. The LNG tankers are about the size of an aircraft carrier. They need big slips, but even more egregious in a sense, they need deeper water than the port currently has. So all this area out in front of us, for them to even get in, is going to have to be dredged. Millions and millions of cubic yards. But even more so, there's a big turnaround basin, and that whole area is going to have to be dredged even deeper than the normal channel.
Tribal people have always said when the tide goes out, the table's set. Our tribe was really quite fortunate because when the tide went out, that's when you went out and got your food.
Estuaries are like nurseries. The baby crabs are there, the little fish. We have migratory birds that come through. We also have native Olympia oysters, and oysters are really important in estuaries because they keep the estuary clean for the other habitat.
When I was a kid, we lived right along the bay. The whole bay was covered with eelgrass. I'd go down and kick around eelgrass and pick up crabs.
Eelgrass is pretty important for estuaries because fish and the crabs kind of hide in there to keep them from getting eaten by other animals up the food chain. Every time they do stuff in the estuary, like when they've done some channel modifications, you start seeing less fish.
They're going to go in there and blow bedrock and dredge all the mud up. Then they're going to stir up all that sediment.
Sam Schwartz is a native of Coos County and an artist, commercial fisherman, and president of the Coos Bay chapter of Surf Rider Foundation.
I'm not only worried about the eelgrass that they'd actually be completely removing, but what all that sediment is going to do to the other eelgrass that's in the bay.
We know there's a problem with high CO2 levels raising the ocean pH. and the ocean acidification is actually causing estuaries to be more acidic, and eelgrass actually counters that. So the more eelgrass you have, the better it helps the shellfish to be able to grow shells. And it's not easy to mitigate eelgrass.
You can't let the bay keep dying the way it is. What's going to happen in the next 20 years? Because there's only 10 or 15% of the eelgrass left.
They want to go dredge these four separate areas along the current navigational channel. But a lot of these areas are zoned natural aquatic. They have a lot of species habitat there right now. Some of the areas towards the entrance of the channel are rock. So they're going to be out there blasting or cutting rock to widen that area. And once they do this, that changes the estuary, the volume, the velocity, the salinity.
Coos Bay is not a traditional deep water port. I'm a commercial fishing boat owner and I'm navigating that channel all the time, and it's easy to get off track really quickly. That's just a 43-foot boat, and now we're imagining these monstrous 800-feet long boats, and their width consumes the entire depth of the channel.
They're trying to put a square peg in a round hole. No matter the fact that it shouldn't go there, they're determined that they're going to do whatever it takes to put it there. The channel is not designed for these huge tankers. So their solution to that is to go gut the channel and then stand up in a meeting saying they're helping the local people. That doesn't help the fishermen and the crabbers and clammers that will probably lose their jobs in the end because of it.
California and Washington said no. They have really strict coastal zone laws and big cities on the coasts, and they aren't going to allow it. Oregon doesn't have those strong coastal zone laws.
I think because we were a rural community, probably not highly educated, and they thought it would be an easy sell.
They're paying off all of our local officials. They've created booster clubs here in our community. It's really created a ton of division within our community.
They also see that some of our counties are kind of depressed. We do need jobs. And so they think they can come in and give us a bunch of empty promises and glossy mailers and TV ads that just look awesome and dangle this carrot out in front of people. They just see this as like the weak spot on the map where they're going to get to do whatever they want. And we've seen that they haven't been able to.
We started winning on a few issues in the land use. Once we realized, oh, here's the code and they don't meet it, then Jordan Cove has come in here with their lawyers and they've changed the code. And all you have to do is just go plop money down at the county and you can change the code. They managed to get the people they want elected, and those people are the decision makers, and they approve the code changes.
Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector intervene on behalf of the county, so they are their legal defense. You have just regular old citizens out there trying to be heard up against these big law firms out of Portland or San Francisco.
The rural communities like ours don't have the means to fight these mammoth people. They've got all this unlimited amount of money, and we're sitting here pulling money out of our household budgets to try to counter them. We stopped them on a few permits, but there's so many they're throwing at us. It's overwhelming, and that's the game. Throw as much as you can and hope something sticks.
It was unbelievable to me, the arguments that they come up with, that they just get away with because unless you challenge them, they just get to run ramshod over the local folks.
When you go to hearings, they bring in their consultants and their lawyers and stuff, and they spin the code to make it say something it really doesn't say. They've decided now, just don't put any information and just see what issues people raise and then only respond to the stuff that's raised. And then if we don't raise it, they get the permit because people didn't realize they didn't meet this criteria over here.
After 15 years of dealing with this, there is a very organized group of people that stay in touch. The folks in rural Oregon that come from all different backgrounds, different belief systems and values have been able to find a way to work together when they've found this shared and common purpose to stop the Pacific Connector gas pipeline and Jordan Cove.
Eminent domain, that's our glue, especially a Canadian company coming in and essentially demanding and essentially being given that authority of eminent domain.
People presume that there's supposed to be a public need or a necessity even to take someone's property for something like a pipeline.
Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper.
There's no need to ship gas overseas. It's not like a sewer line that your neighborhood needs or a power line that your city needs.
They're wanting to call it a utility, but not one cubic foot of gas would be used here, but all the profits would go to a Canadian company and stockholders.
In Jackson County especially, people have really been coming together for their neighbors who are impacted by this project.
Allie Rosenbluth, Rogue Climate.
The Jackson County commissioners actually oppose the pipeline because of eminent domain and are increasingly concerned about the impacts on the county's water and public safety.
We're about 3 miles from the proposed plant. In between here, which would really be the end of the pipe, and the beginning of the pipe at Malin, Oregon, there are about 240 private landowners. Pembina has been able to talk a little more than half of them into signing easements with them. And the other little less than half are still fighting against it.
The threat of this pipeline hanging over people's heads for 14 years has been incredibly stressful. People can't sell their homes because they can't get the fair market value because of this threat of a pipeline. It's caused incredible emotional distress.
As the landowner coordinator for Coos County, Larry Mangan fields phone calls from other landowners in the county impacted by the pipeline who have questions or need support.
Cynthia lives out in the Coquille Valley, 45 minutes east of Coos Bay. They were doing their surveys from low-flying helicopters. She had not given access to their property for them to do surveys. Helicopters were flying so low they spooked her cows. Her cows almost tore through the fence. She called the company and protested. Several weeks later, the land agent came by and asked her, well, what did you think of this last offer? And she said, I'm not really interested. You know, I've told you that, and I don't want you on my property. So the agent said, well, you know that block valve you don't like? These big 36-inch pipes that come up out of the ground. If you sign right now, we'll make sure that block valve gets put on one of your neighbor's property. But if you don't sign right now, that block valve is going to stay right in the middle of your property, right in the middle of your view.
Many people living along the pipeline route are elderly, and for the last 15 years, this project created a lot of uncertainty for them as to how to deal with the threat of this on top of the other things that they have to deal with as they're growing older.
In Douglas County, a landowner was having financial difficulties. They did a credit check on him, and they saw that he had a lot of debt. And also, very, very unfortunately, he had early Alzheimer's disease. They were going in and harassing him, trying to get him to sign, when his guardian finally called the sheriff and told him to keep them away from this poor fellow.
One of my neighbors, early on, signed an easement when it was an import-only project, and that was okay with him. But when he found out that it was being exported from Canada to Asia, he went ballistic. He said, that is not what I signed on for. Once you sign that easement agreement, you don't know what is going to go in the ground on your property. A lot of my neighbors who have shifted and have signed easements, it's not about the money, but it's enough money that they can get on with their lives somewhere else. And they're tired. 15 years is a long time to be bullied. It's a long time to be threatened, to wait while someone else is trying to decide what your future is going to be. And it's really maddening as an American citizen that all of this is coming from a foreign country and our own government is not stepping up for us.
Some landowners have been involved in this a lot longer than we have. Poor souls, they've been on this pipeline for more than 14 years. And there's a great network that we found our way into when we were notified in March of 2017.
Because of all the letters and action that we've taken, we have been taken off the main route, but we're still considered on the alternate route. But whether or not we're on the main route, we just don't want it for our communities. We've joined together with other property owners to really fight this action.
One of the things that Rogue Climate prioritized when they jumped into this fight was bringing all of these people together and showing them the importance of working together across county. It's really disempowering to feel like you're the only one who cares about something that impacts so many people. I think it's about showing people that there are people who really do care about this.
We connected ourselves with some of the folks concerned about a pipeline going right through their dream home and property. They contacted us thinking that maybe we had a real strong hammer if there's cultural resources there.
Don Gentry, whose Klamath name is Dichukyunk, is the chairman of the Klamath Tribes.
The pipeline's going to come through an area that has high density population of our tribal people, pretty well recorded historically there on the Klamath River. So we knew that the risk to cultural sites and even exposing human remains is significant.
The tribal people here are placed here on this earth to take care of the treaty resources.
Taylor Tupper is a Modoc Indian. Her tribal name is Laminowatch Thunder Horse.
Because if you don't take care of the resources, you can't eat money and you can't drink oil. So it's not really even about you and I. It's about this next seven generations.
It's in our worldview and basically our responsibility to protect the treaty rights and interests of our people. There's no way in the world that we cannot oppose a project like this that moves us in the wrong direction that way.
All the tribes talk about the prophecy of the black snake. We're in the seventh generation. This seventh generation is the generation that turns things over. There's no way that this tribe, our youth, myself, my ancestors, are going to back down regarding this black snake.
The Klamath tribes have been such a leader in opposing this project, which is amazing considering all of the other things that are happening in the Klamath River Basin that they're trying to protect as well. I am so grateful to get to work with so many tribal members who have taught me a lot about how to live in Southern Oregon on land that has such a violent history.
I was working for the tribes when they widened Highway 97 a little bit just south of Klamath Falls, very close to where this pipeline is coming through. They unearthed human remains and scattered bone fragments for, I think, about 100 yards or so. It was an ugly feeling for that to happen. Even though I couldn't say, hey, that was one of my Modoc or Klamath ancestors, it was our people. We know that there's a lot of remains there, and the risk isn't acceptable.
They should be listening to the tribes. You can't go through there because there's a big Indian burial. Well, that's going to cost us $1 million to go around that. So we'll just go until we hit something, then we'll mitigate it. Well, that's disrespectful.
Perry Chalkfoot is the director of the Cultural and Heritage Department for the Klamath Tribes and is on the Klamath Tribal Council.
If I was to take a shovel and walk to your family's cemetery and just start digging and say, well, I'm not going to stop digging until I hit something, you're going to say no. That's what we're telling you. No.
The Klamath tribes have been in these water wars here in the basin for so long.
Taylor Tupper.
We were working on the pre-licensing process for those four dams that are on the Klamath River. In 1917, when that first dam was built, it was put in writing by Pacific Corps that they would build the promised fish ladders. And people ask, why didn't they just build the fish ladders that they promised? Well, because the federal government had a genocide policy that they were going to be moving forward to get rid of all the tribes in the nation. So they didn't think in 2006 there'd still be a tribe to have to deal with. They terminated us in 1954, but we worked hard and was restored in 1986. So then when we asked, well, what about these dams and the fish ladders, they basically told us, oh, well, you need to wait till 06. That gives us all these years to prepare for the relicensing process, which we win in 06. They determine on their own that it's more costly to put the fish ladders on those four dams on the Klamath River than to just take them out. Here we are, 2019. First dam is supposed to be slotted to be removed in 2020. There is no way in hell we are going to allow a pipeline to mess what we've been working on since 1917 to bring back the salmon.
You're listening to Holding the Thin Green Line, Part 4, Rising Tide of Resistance.
Who loves Oregon? Who supports a robust economy? And who supports good-paying career family jobs? And of all the places, why not Oregon? Where the commitment to build with all union labor trades assures the best, safest, and most reliable project terminal.
Over 6,000 jobs will initially be put forward on this project. 2,000 in the terminal, 4,000 in the pipeline. 180 people at the LNG terminal have long-term jobs in Coos Bay.
They make it sound like they're going to go to the residents of Coos County, but they have trained staff that come from other areas.
Sylvia Mangan, Coos County landowner impacted by the pipeline.
The local people that might be hired eventually when the whole project is finished, it's about 150 people.
This facility will sit right next to a Dunes National Recreation Area. Thousands of people come and use that.
Jody McCaffrey, Citizens for Renewables in Coos Bay.
All those people buy gas, they shop in our stores. We haven't overdeveloped our coastline. You can do a lot of cool things here that you just can't do other places. and millions of dollars every year come into our area from the tourism industry.
People don't come down here to see huge LNG tankers.
Larry Mangan, who's county landowner impacted by the pipeline.
Huge stadium-sized tanks on their previously unspoiled coastline.
You're going to impact spawning grounds. That means you're going to impact the fishing industry. You know, they're talking jobs. You're going to lose jobs. People that work in growing oysters and clammers and crabbers and fishermen, this is their livelihood down here.
They're only going to be able to bring those ships in at high tide. And that's when most of the people go out crabbing.
Doc Slider, Coos Lower Umpqua Isla Elder.
And so they're going to close down the bay right in the top time of crabbing?
Our bay is very narrow, and the safety and security zone around these tankers is quite large. Once you start kicking recreational boaters out of the bay, people will go somewhere else.
Jordan Cove has been spending tens of millions of dollars in our community to try to promote this project.
Hannah Soule, Rogue Climate.
To say that they're protecting the environment, they are protecting coho salmon.
We started getting these, what we call them, giant Hallmark cards. There are these beautiful scenes of Oregon. Pembina saying, this is what's important to us too. And it talks about how great Jordan Cove is gonna be.
I can't get on my computer to check my email with getting this pop-up talking about how wonderful Jordan Cove is. It just turns my stomach that people can try to make this sound like it's a good thing when I know it's not.
We have huge one-page ads in the newspapers that come out saying how great Jordan Cove is. They're spending millions of dollars because they know they don't have public support. In fact, our landowners polled all the districts from Portland all the way down to Medford, and all of Oregon is against the pipeline, some as much as 70%. Even Coos County was against it, which arguably is most likely to get 150 jobs.
They can keep spending their $10 million a month.
Taylor Tupper.
And they can hire so-called tribal liaisons for economic development. And they can put on every station their propaganda. Their commercials are lies. They're not talking about 485 waterways that they're looking to ruin in the state of Oregon. They don't talk about how they want to ruin the clean air quality in the state of Oregon. They say that they're our friends. But do you think that we don't understand that the devil is good looking?
In 2016, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, denied the key federal permit for this project. That was only the second time that FERC has ever denied a permit for a project like this.
FERC is the federal agency that approves or denies energy projects for the country.
Robin Jansen, Rogue River Keeper.
FERC's always been known as just the rubber stamp approval agency for fossil fuel projects.
The reason why FERC denied this project was because the company had so few landowners that had actually signed easements, and so many people along the pipeline route are strongly opposed to this project.
Part of the other issue was that Verizon was the company at the time, and now it's Pembina, didn't have any contracts with buyers at all. Right away, the company, as we had expected, came back to ask for a rehearing of FERC's decision. And then again on December 9th of 2016, FERC restated their denial of the project and it was finalized. Jody and some landowners were here for an interview in Ashland, so everybody was here to celebrate together. But I think everybody also didn't trust it and was kind of waiting for the shoe to drop.
The unfortunate part is Donald Trump was elected president in the middle of all of it.
Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper.
His lead economic advisor at the time was Gary Cohn, and Gary Cohn called Jordan Cove one of the biggest economic priorities for the Trump administration.
3 days later, the company put out a press release saying they were going to reapply in January after the inauguration of President Trump.
There's a lot of concern about the Trump administration trying to rewrite the rules in ways that make it more difficult for states to have a clear decision on these big pipeline projects. Where we see the impact very clearly is with FERC, which is going out of its way not to consider any climate impacts of major energy projects.
Even if FERC changes their mind and approves the project this time, there are so many different opportunities for our state government to deny permits and stop this project once and for all.
Our reliance right now is ultimately on Governor Brown.
Larry Mangan.
We're disappointed that she hasn't come out against it so far, but we have hope that eventually the state, whether it's through the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, whether it's through the Division of State Lands, or maybe even the governor's office, we hope and we pray that Governor Brown will be the one to help us.
If Governor Kate Brown wants part of her legacy to be that she's a climate champion and taking action on climate, she cannot let this project go through because the impact of this project would completely wipe out any other steps forward that our state makes on climate legislation.
Jordan Cove would be exporting twice as much gas as the entire state of Oregon uses for everything. Homes, businesses, power plants, everything.
Future generations will judge us not on the fact of global climate change, but what we've done to tackle it.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown speaking at the state capitol on June 20th, 2019.
It's critically important that we take action and that we take action now.
I see our governor trying in other realms to be more of that environmental voice for the state. And I'm just really hopeful that she's just playing it cool right now and that she interjects her power with the state agencies and helps make the right decision.
Another state agency that's really important in this fight is the Department of State Lands, which reviews and approves or denies what's known as a removal fill permit.
Stacy Detweiler, Rogue Riverkeeper.
And they're really looking at impacts to our waterways, impacts to navigation and recreation, any activities where the company is proposing to fill in wetlands, dredge out Coos Bay.
We are going to sing a song. Pull out your song sheet. And the song goes like this. I'll sing it once and then we'll all sing it together. You ready? People gonna rise like the water. We're gonna shut this pipeline down. I hear the voice of my great-grandchild saying, keep it in the ground. One more time.
The hearings are a really exciting time for us because it's a opportunity for everybody to get together and hear from their neighbors.
The last round we did this, 200 people showed up, which is a really big turnout for Jackson County. This time there were over 1,800 people there.
It was at the Jackson County Expo. The interstate was backed up with cars waiting to get off the freeway. A lot of people texted me, Allie, I can't make it to the hearing. There's a traffic jam into the expo. And I was just like, no, come, like, we want you here.
We had no idea that many people would show up. The line to get into the room that only held 700 people stretched all the way around the block. My heart just swells and my whole body gets shivers because it shows how effective this campaign has been and how people are really sick of this project and they don't want to see it happen.
When people finally got into the hearing room, it was a sea of people wearing red t-shirts. All different types of people came to raise their voices. There were ranchers, tribal members, youth, health professionals, fishing guides, there were firefighters.
People would get up and read their testimony, and a lot of folks would ask, who here opposes this project? And you just see 90% of the hands in the room go up in the air.
How's everybody doing today?
Great! Outside of the hearing room, in a separate room, we had a big rally beforehand that was led by youth in our community.
We wanted to get people excited, give an opportunity for press to ask questions to folks who are impacted by the project in many, many ways. And also meet people in your community who have similar concerns as you, because that's how we build that network and that support that people need to be able to continue fighting this project for so many years.
Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove!
I'm begging for you, please don't take this land.
Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove, Jordan Cove! Please don't
take it just because you can.
Thank you all for coming out to stop the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal and Pacific Connector Pipeline. We have hundreds of community members here in Coos Bay and the surrounding areas out today. And I hope that everyone has a great evening here together, stopping the Jordan Cove LNG project and Pacific Connector Pipeline.
The Department of State Lands hearing in January in Coos Bay was also like really, really powerful because so many people in that community use the bay on a regular basis and know so much about it.
I'm here to surf and to protect. I'm chair of Surf Rider Foundation. I also own a commercial fishing boat. We did a little recreational crabbing, and the best crabs that we caught were right there where the Jordan Cove terminal would be, where they want to put these tankers. We live here, we eat the stuff that comes out of the water. It's a very precious ecosystem. And it's already stressed out. It's time to change our patterns as human beings on this planet. It all starts here, it all starts now, denying this permit.
The big conference room was filled to overflowing.
400, 450 people. Unheard of a crowd for Coos Bay. All the people against Jordan Cove were asked to wear red. Based on the number of red shirts, it was probably 4-1 against Jordan Cove.
It was great to see all the red shirts and people that I hadn't seen in years.
Jody McCaffrey.
I think they got like 50,000 comments. Unbelievable.
What was really unusual is DSL sent a letter back to Pembina and says, here are some areas that we found that were inconsistent, inaccurate, needed more information. And they sent along about 18 comment submissions from individuals, kind of a laundry list of folks we've been working with. And they said, rather than Department of State Lands, DSL, picking out the issues, they just answer these whole 40, 50, 60 page submissions that people put in. And from what I understand, that was unheard of. It's never been done before.
In Klamath County, it was really an incredible turnout as well, especially for the size of that community. The Klamath tribes turned out a lot of their membership. Before the hearing, there was a rally that the Klamath Youth Tribal Council led with Chairman Don Gentry and a lot of other important leaders in the tribe.
I am water from Klamath and Crater Lake. What happened to the respect for sacred land and clean energy? It is a given to protect and love our fish. For all my relations and next generations. Another shout out to Kate Brown and state agencies to not let us down.
Just like Jackson County, there was a huge sea of red, and you could tell that people who were there from this place were the folks in red, and the people that Pembina had brought to show support of this project had never been to Klamath County in their life. It was again just another clear demonstration that our communities in Southern Oregon are asking the state to do something, and that's to stop this project.
We had some really good news for once.
The Department of Environmental Quality in Oregon denied Clean Water Act 401 certification for the Jordan Cove project. This is one of the permits that Pembina can't build this project without. When the state made this decision, they also issued about 200 pages of all of the places in which this project would degrade Oregon's waterways.
It was like too good to be true. But then, you know, as soon as you get that good news, and there's certainly cause for celebration, you don't want to jinx it by dancing too much because you know there's still a lot of other things that could happen.
The state is giving an opportunity for the company to reapply for this permit. So our communities have to fight it yet again once that new application comes in. Right now, it sounds like Pembina is going to reapply for that 401 permit. But also at the same time, Pembina is trying to sell 40 to 60% of this project to somebody else. They have reduced their spending to $50 million a year, which was really a significant drop compared to what they've been spending the past year. If the state of Oregon continues to do what's best for our communities, then this company should not be able to build this project. But it's going to take all of us coming out again and doing that hard work of educating our communities and bringing people together to stop it for good. And we need to make sure that Pembina sees that.
In August 2019, The Guardian newspaper featured an article that began, "Law enforcement groups, including the FBI, have been monitoring opponents of the Jordan Cove Energy Project, a natural gas infrastructure project in Oregon, and circulated intelligence to an email list that included a Republican-aligned anti-environmental PR operative."
There's a multi-agency task force that I assume includes other sheriff departments in the state of Oregon and includes the FBI. Our sheriffs that we pay to help us are now surveilling us.
They are being told by Pembina they want protesters to be stopped. This is just shocking to me because they are supposed to be public servants. They're supposed to be supporting and protecting Oregonians. And this is a foreign country coming in saying, thou shalt go after protesters.
I actually talked with Sheriff's Deputy Doug Strain. Deputy Strain says, nobody like you, Mr. Mangan, would be surveilled. And he said, let me give you some examples of what we are really looking at. Down in Northern California, they're surveilling the Yurok Tribe. And about a year ago, there was some kind of rally down in the Grants Pass area. And this one gentleman said, I will do anything to stop the pipeline. Deputy Strain said, well, that's what we're concerned about. Doing anything, that could mean terrorism or something against the law. If that's the trigger for really checking out somebody and further digging into their activities in their past, that's really scary.
I used to go to meetings saying that somebody was in my system, because every time comments were due, my system would start acting up. And then the minute the deadline was over with, work fine. So when they came out that there had been surveillance, I thought, I've known that for a long time. And I know that every word that goes out on my email, somebody's probably getting a copy of that and looking at it.
We get interference on phone calls, and I'll be talking to another landowner, I'll be talking to somebody with another organization, Rogue Climate, whatever, and the calls are dropping routinely and regularly. And I'm like, they're not going to be going into those extremes and those depths, but I don't know. You know, I have no idea if I'm on a list. I have no idea if I'm considered an extremist.
I think that they're watching probably everybody. Even though I've never done anything but promote the process, that here's a chance to have comments, here's what you can say, I'm sure that I'm still being watched.
In some of these industry meetings, they've actually talked about and bragged about legislation that they've been successful in getting passed that would limit our ability and our voice to protest or to actively stand against something that we are opposed to.
A couple times I could not get my testimony in through email. My computer just locked up, wouldn't function, and then they didn't arrive in time. So they told me that my comments were too late and they threw them out.
Well, I just made a new friend in the community, and she contacted me this morning. She knows I'm involved in protesting Jordan Cove. She really wants to get involved, but she expressed multiple concerns about the threatening atmosphere when she attends city council meetings. And when she makes comments, she has had somebody actually from the opposition side stand up and directly face her and yell at her, and he wasn't stopped. She definitely felt intimidated and was asking me, should she attend? Is it safe?
That evening, the Coos Bay City Council held a special meeting about Jordan Cove's request to expedite the council's decision on their application to dredge the estuary. At a meeting the previous month, the council decided they needed 5 months to review all the documents and community comments. Now, Jordan Cove was asking for the council to make the decision 7 weeks sooner. The community came out in force, largely opposed to rushing the council's decision. While one of the Jordan Cove opponents was speaking, a supporter of the project snarled as he pushed past her.
We have all taken the time to research and write and submit 42 pages.
Oh, God.
So I hope you will. I'm sorry, I'm not used to being growled at when I'm speaking, and it disrupts my train of thought.
It's not just the individual people who are being bullied. One of the county commissioners said to me after the end of a meeting that we can't afford to take your side. We can't afford to do anything but approve this permit because they'll have us stuck in court forever, and they've got the money to do it. And what happens is the counties don't defend themselves against us. Pembina does. They step in as the intervener and provide the legal defense and assistance for the local governments. But if they were to stand with any of their local constituents, they would have to defend themselves, because we can't step up with a bottomless pit of money to support our side.
My name is Larry Mangan. I suggest that you not bow to the pressure from the company. A number of us go to the North Bend City Council meetings and Coos County Commissioner meetings and see some of the same pressure on making decisions.
I'm the co-chair of Boost Southern Oregon, representing over 1,400 individuals. And if you just read a little bit faster, let's shorten the date.
Pushing for an earlier deadline is not respecting our boundaries. It is comparative to tactics used by aggressive and manipulative people when they feel they are losing ground and want to regain the upper hand. Pushing the commission to rush its decision-making process is putting Jordan Cove's interests first and the citizens of Coos County second.
This is a heavy-handed, corrupt approach to securing permits.
Well, lying has become the new norm. And I know agency people that have tried to participate and got in trouble because it was against the project. What they do is they decide they're going to sit there and be a good little government employee and not make waves.
When you look at the scope and the breadth of Jordan Cove's influence in our political system in Oregon, it is very scary. They've bought and paid for commissioners over in Coos County.
One of our county commissioners, they gave $50,000 to get him elected. That's like unheard of. Who has that kind of money around here to run for county commissioner?
They've put millions of dollars behind elections. That is unheard of in rural communities.
So basically, you're getting their people in, they change the codes for them, and the codes that should be changed to protect the estuary, those are not happening. We've been complaining for 7 years to get these codes updated. What's looked at is, well, you just mitigate this and you'll be fine, or you do an exception to the rule and you'll be fine. Citizens are left with having to challenge that. And we've quite successfully challenged them and beat them because they know they're not in compliance with the codes. So the way they get around that now, like in North Bend, they're charging us such high planning fees for appealing a decision that was not even close to being adequate. They're talking $5,000 to $60,000 per appeal.
There are a lot of local governments, counties between Malin and Coos Bay that have to approve a segment of the pipeline. We're waiting on 29 or 30 local permits that Jordan Cove has to get. Still got that feeling in our stomach, we're not quite sure where things are going. We're waiting on a decision from the Department of State Lands on the fill permit for the Jordan Cove project.
What they did was extend the deadline. Over 50,000 people submitted comments, most of them in opposition to the project, along with very specific information as to what DSL needed to address. And Jordan Cove had a specific amount of time to respond. They were not complete in their responses, and therefore DSL pushed it out.
Department of State Lands asked for clarification from Jordan Cove, and they gave him some response, but it wasn't the appropriate response. So they're going back for more information to clarify that. And that's going to put it into the next year as well.
There's a double standard clearly in place around this project with the state of Oregon. We've asked the Department of Justice, we've asked the governor's office, we've specifically addressed Department of State Lands. When are you going to honor your own process and your own deadlines? I certainly don't get an opportunity to wait to submit information. I have to meet those deadlines and then I have to submit everything by a certain time.
There is a point where all this needs to end and somebody needs to say no, and they need to say it's with prejudice, so that you can't keep coming back because you've had your time and you didn't do it right. When they keep being allowed to just kick the can down the road or make a decision without prejudice and they can come back, we're here 15 years and it's torture. This is torture on our area. We can't even really try to do something else that would be more compatible with our fishing and crabbing. We're just so busy. Every week there's a deadline for some land use process, for some comment. Rebuttal comments, or sur-rebuttal comments, or they pull their application and they reapply. We've had that so many times, I'm just tired of it.
After the Department of State Lands announced the extension for Jordan Cove's removal fill permit, Stacy McLaughlin wrote this letter to the agency's director, Vicki Walker.
For 15 years, my family has been held hostage to the bullying and threat of eminent domain to take our property by foreign corporations. Veresen, Williams, and now Pembina are opportunistic predator companies. They have virtually paralyzed other economic development prospects in our rural communities with their speculative Jordan Cove venture and snake oil rhetoric. And for 15 years, the state of Oregon has diddled with this project and followed Jordan Cove's dangling carrot and let its own taxpaying citizens suffer in favor of nameless Canadian shareholders. This project has already been denied several times by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector and its other three different owners haven't been able to get everything together in the last 15 years, then the state of Oregon needs to step up and tell them to go home to Canada. Know that my family is fully prepared to do whatever it takes legally to protect our home and property from the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. They can end this nightmare now. And they have the authority to do it. And Governor Brown needs to step up and take care of business if she is the environmental advocate that she continues to proclaim.
The reason I've stuck in it is because I don't think you should lie and cheat and try to manipulate the system to get a permit. If you got to do that, then maybe your project should be really looked at, because it ain't all it's cracked up to be. There's a reason why those regulations are there. The reason we're having to do all these land use permits here locally is because Coos County is in the coastal zone, and we have the Coastal Zone Management Act, and that requires a little extra level of protection. That's supposed to be to preserve and protect, not just for us, but for the next generation.
Jody has fought long and hard, and she's held it together, and our community owes her a whole lot of gratitude. And there's a whole bunch of younger families, younger entrepreneurs, we don't want to raise our families here. We don't want to grow our businesses here if this type of industry comes into our town.
Governor Brown, shut it down! Governor Brown, shut it down!
Miigwech, thank you for being here today to urge Governor Brown to stand up to the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal and Pipeline! Governor Brown and Oregon state agencies have the power to stop Jordan Cove LNG pipeline for good. We're here to tell Governor Brown to do all she can to protect our communities, not protect the special corporate interests of a Canadian fossil fuel corporation.
In November 2019, hundreds of Jordan Cove opponents gathered at the Oregon State Capitol to call on Governor Brown to finally take a stand against Jordan Cove LNG. After a rally, the protesters poured into the Capitol building, filling the echoing rotunda with song. Meanwhile, 85 impacted landowners, tribal members, and their supporters staged a sit-in in the governor's office, refusing to leave until the governor publicly opposed the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connector gas pipeline. Several hours later, Governor Brown came in to speak to the protesters for 10 minutes and answer some of their questions, but she refused to take a stand. An hour later, 21 protesters were arrested. Holding the Thin Green Line was written, narrated, and produced by Barbara Bernstein, who also composed and performed the music. Flute music was composed and performed by Doc Slider. Renew My Hope was written and performed by Alder Manning. Melissa Marsland and Patsy Colbert were editing consultants. This program was funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and Stephen and Jan Marks. Special thanks to Columbia Riverkeeper, Power Pass Frack Gas, Rogue Climate, Ali Rosenbluth, and Larry and Sylvia Mangan. For more information about how to hold the Thin Green Line, go to our website, holdingthethingreenline.org.